You're listening to the Screaming Pods Network.
I want you to talk to me about May. Are you very much in love with her?
As much as a man can be.
Do you think there's a limit?
In that moment, he begins along the path, which is inevitably going to get him into one hell of a lot of trouble.
Perhaps I've been too independent. All I really want is to feel cared for and safe.
I don't think she realizes again how provocative she's being.
Is there someone else?
Someone else? Between you and me?
I've never really done a period film before of this kind. I was always interested because I've been a great fan of period films over the years. You know, I like very much The Heiress. Did you ever see that?
Yes, I did.
Montgomery
yeah.
Clifton
yeah.
And Ralph Richardson and Olivia de Havilland. And I think one of the things I liked about The Heiress a lot was the accessibility of the characters.
Yeah.
And I hope that when people see The Age of Innocence, there's a sense of being placed into that morality of the time,
yeah.
So that they understand what these conflicts are.
May guess the truth. There is another woman.
The themes, which are love, passion, conscience, commitment, they're pertinent and immediate and compelling at any time, whether it's 1993 or 2010.
Nothing's done that can't be undone. I'm still free. You can be too. Please.
We have the same problems of wanting things that we can't have and having things that we don't want. And that's what this story is about.
Hello there, and welcome to this episode of Just the Discs. This is a Criterion-centric episode I'm doing with my wife. Hello, wife.
Hello, husband.
This is a snapshot of how we address each other at home.
Pretty much.
Yeah, so this is like documentary audio.
Yes, husband.
Anyway, we are talking about two movies. We're going to talk about them in reverse order from the way we watched them, because
Age of Innocence first.
Yes. So first up is Martin Scorsese's Age of Innocence from 1993.
Okay.
The year I graduated high school. The back of the disc says, no filmmaker.
Almost the year I graduated college.
You didn't have to do that. You just could have just left it a cryptic look that nobody could see.
Now they know. You can cut this.
Now they know you're the older woman. The back says, no filmmaker captures the grandeur and energy of New York like Martin Scorsese. With this sumptuous romance, he meticulously adapted the work of another great New York artist, Edith Wharton, bringing to life her tragic novel set in the cloistered world of Gilded Age Manhattan. The Age of Innocence tells the story of Newland Archer, Daniel Day-Lewis, whose engagement to an innocent socialite, Winona Ryder, binds him to the codes and rituals of his upbringing. But when her cousin, Michelle Pfeiffer, arrives in town on a wave of scandal after separating from her husband, she ignites passions in Newland he never knew existed. Swelling with exquisite period detail, this film is an alternately heartbreaking and satirical look at the brutality of old world America.
This unique world of the Age of Innocence, violence and hostility expressed through very elaborate etiquette and ritual. So really, for me, it was a fascinating overall view of a world that had all the same, basically the same passions, but was hidden through this, behind this lace, in a way. There's very, very intricate woodwork of etiquette and extraordinary rituals, also with a maybe a sweet kind of perversity of repression.
So we had both seen this movie before.
Yep.
Now, did you see it in the theater? You couldn't remember.
Yeah, no, I did. I saw it in the theater.
Okay, I definitely didn't see it in the theater.
Too young.
Not too young. I was working at video stores. I was in the thick of my first video store job. Probably
kept you away from the movies. It was so busy and hard.
Well, I was probably 2 years in, and I just don't think I went to the movies as much then, because there was always movies to rent for free. And I mean, I remember having some money because I was working, but not enough that I necessarily wanted to go to the movies all the time when I could rent free movies. So I think I rented this at some point, and I was very much in a post Goodfellas, you know, loving Scorsese phase. I don't think I'd seen Taxi Driver yet. But anyway, when I saw it the first time, I didn't care for it. I didn't know what to make of it. I was too young to deal with it. Yeah, Tisk, exactly. But then, you know, I've seen it again and liked it more, and each time.
How many times have you seen this?
I mean, this is probably my third time, I think. Okay. This is your second or third?
I think it's only my second.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So what are your thoughts on it? What do you like about it?
I like how there's so much passion in just a touch.
Yeah.
I like how looks and very delicate things create fire in the movie. And I think that that's kind of beautiful compared to what we are used to seeing in films. I think that show a lot more to get even sometimes less of a passion response out of me. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I think it's interesting because I don't particularly love period drama. I'm very half in, half out on it. And Scorsese just sets it up really well, where he just sort of shows the sort of societal infrastructure and the norms and the traditions and practices and how reserved everyone is, how they don't really say what they mean. It's very cloistered, I guess, is the word they used in the back there. Yeah. And so, like you say, it sets like this base level of like everything is just so inhibited and so repressed or whatever. And then, so like you say, when Daniel Day-Lewis like touches her hand, I found myself almost gasping, you know, just like, oh my goodness, like you're watching some kind of explicit material, because he so well establishes the world, and the actors do the same thing. They just really portray the stiffness and the, I don't know, the imprisonment, basically, is the way I look at it. It's kind of a sad state that this was. I mean, I guess
I think the whole movie is very melancholy. I definitely have that feeling. And I remember feeling a lot more sad the first time I saw it, I think. But I still felt sad at the ending. And just in general, I felt sad.
Yeah, I forgot the ending. Totally. You said you remembered it, but remembered it differently.
I remembered it a tiny bit differently, but I remembered like the exact scene and the setting and all of that. But
well, now I think I'll probably remember. I don't know why I had forgotten it. For some reason, the ending. I think sometimes with certain love stories, I want the partially the romantic in me and partially the movie watcher, the regular movie watcher in me, remembers things a certain way because I feel like that's how movies usually end. And I'm trying not to spoil the ending of the movie, particularly, although I feel like I'm leaning into spoiling it. But so I think sometimes I create endings, or I have like sense memories of endings that aren't really real. And I kind of like that, because then you get to the end of a movie. And that's ultimately what engages me. And you probably have the same thing with a movie, is like sometimes you've seen a movie, but you
forget the details. And
you definitely forget the ending. So you're just like, okay, well, I remember this part and this scene, but I don't remember how it ends. So I kind of want to, and then you start to like second guess the ending, go, I think, you know, maybe I do. But then, you know, ultimately I've forgotten. It's one of the nice things about getting old. But
That happened to me when I was young. So,
well, you always say how you don't remember details from movies, but then you seem to remember a lot of stuff. Like you remember that last shot and
random details. And I think I have a good visual memory.
Yeah.
So,
well, that makes sense. So, was there anything in particular? Like, do you like any of the particular performances better than others? Or,
well, obviously Daniel Day-Lewis' performance, probably out of all of them, is my favorite. I think Michelle Pfeiffer was good too. I guess because of the character that Winona Ryder plays. I think she played that character well.
Yeah.
But I didn't like her in this as much as I do in other movies. And it's interesting because in other movies that I see her with, and I did have a Winona Ryder thing for a while where I definitely saw like all these movies that she was in.
I did, and I kind of still do.
But I think that in this movie, I think she probably looks most beautiful that I've seen her in a lot of movies, but yet I don't connect or feel, I'm almost not rooting for her character in it.
Well, yeah.
And there's
certainly at a point, because at the beginning you feel like, oh, she's just very naive. And then you're like, oh, wait a minute, there's more going on here. There is a naivete and there is a want to believe in the society that she's brought up in. But there's also some sort of, not, I don't want to say cleverness, but like a slightly conniving.
Yeah, no, I think there's some manipulation and that makes me upset because I almost feel like if you don't truly, I don't know how much she really loved him. As much as it was like how it was just going to be. And in the and in some point, well, you do find out that I guess she does love him.
It's a complicated marriage. It's a complicated love story between the two of them.
Let's talk frankly, Newland. I felt a difference in you, especially since our engagement.
Since our engagement?
If it's untrue, then it won't hurt to talk about it. And if it is true, then why shouldn't we talk about it now? I mean, you might have made a mistake.
If I'd made some sort of a mistake, would I be down here asking you to hurry our marriage?
I don't know, you might. It would be one way to settle the question. In Newport, 2 years ago, before we were promised, everyone said there was someone else for you. I even saw you with her once, sitting together on a veranda at a dance. When she came into the house, her face looked so sad. I felt sorry for her. And even after, when we were engaged, I could still see how she looked, and it...
Is that all you've been concerned about? It's long past.
Then is there something else?
No. Of course not.
Whatever it may have been, Newland, I can't have my happiness made out of a wrong to somebody else. If promises were made, or if you feel in some way pledged to this person, even if it means her getting a divorce, then Newland, don't give her up because of me.
There are no pledges. There are no promises that matter. That's all I've been trying to say. There is no one between us. There is nothing between us, May. Which is precisely my argument for getting married. Quickly.
Yeah, I mean, and then the ending speaks to a certain, I don't know, like, I really like the ending because it really is something that makes me think, like, again, we won't spoil it, but, like, is he thinking, who is he thinking about in the end? Is it just about himself? Is it just about his own point of view?
Well, I can tell you who he's thinking about, but then I would spoil it.
Obviously, no, but I mean, like, is there a resonance of other things that motivate his actions at the ending? And I think it's clear, but anyway, I really like this movie though. And it's one that had you told me when I first saw it that I would like it as much as I do now, I would have really been perplexed. I would have been like, I just don't see that.
And not to ruin things in terms of like expectations, because I totally hate when that happens. But I feel like the more I think about it, the ending's my favorite part. And it's the thing to me that makes the movie. And I think it's, I don't want to say a bold ending, but I think it's a fit ending, but maybe not expected ending. I'm not sure how you would exactly say it. And the more I reflect upon it, I really do find that, you know, I don't want to say brilliant, but I just did.
Yeah, no, it really completes the film in the proper way. I feel like...
Aha, no pun intended.
Yeah, well, no, but... But if I feel like if it went a different direction, I can't picture what that would be. I don't, now that I, for whatever I conjured up in my head, I legitimately can't picture what that last scene would be.
Otherwise.
Yeah, it just doesn't, like, there's no satisfying version of that last scene that doesn't play the way it actually ends, if that makes sense. I'm very cryptic, I know, but...
I don't know if that's cryptic. I feel like you're... saying too much.
No, anyway, what do you think of the photography? I think Scorsese worked with cinematographer Michael Ballhaus, and I think he's one of the great cinematographers of the past 30 years. Like, there's one particular shot where Michelle Pfeiffer is standing on a dock at, I guess, sunset, and there's a lighthouse and the sun is reflecting off the water. And I was marking to you that I think that nowadays, sadly, not to be one of those people, but because of CG and because of what you can do with digital, it kind of undercuts your appreciation for how hard that shot would have been to get and how beautiful it is as a photographed image. It's gorgeous. It's like stuck in my head, been for days, basically.
I personally like, and again, I feel like I've said this before about other movies, but I feel like the set design is really beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I guess I have like this weird passion or interest in set design. I feel like that really makes a movie for me. And the lighting, of course,
yeah.
I thought was really nice. And the way, and there's very particular points throughout the film where they light him in a certain way. And you're used to like seeing women lit in a certain way, but I really like how they chose to light Daniel Day-Lewis. And I think that the lighting tells a story in and of itself. And I think that that's important because obviously there would be no film without light, right? So I find that fascinating.
Yeah, no, there's one particular shot that sticks with me that is just the back of his head. And it's just really interesting. I don't know too many people other than Scorsese. I mean, other people have done back of the head shots, but I just realized in seeing it that I was like, wow, I haven't seen somebody shooting the back of somebody's head, especially their star player, in a long time. And it's done at the perfect moment and it's lit really well, you know, just the back of his head. But anyway, this is the Criterion Blu-ray that we watched. It's very pretty. It's a new restored 4K digital restoration approved by Scorsese. There's new interviews with Scorsese, co-screenwriter Jay Cox, production designer Dante Ferretti, and costume designer Gabriella Pescucci.
One of the things about the movie that's very, very important is the sounds of people's voices. And I know that you'd had people to recordings of
Franklin Roosevelt.
Roosevelt and Alice Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt's daughter, if I remember correctly, that recording of Whitman reciting America.
Yes, Ample Street.
Ample.
At the end of the 19th century, there is some research material for pronunciation. Mm-hmm. They aren't speaking with a British accent, but they're the children of England. It was a country still defining itself.
Yes.
A culture, I should say, finding itself. Mm-hmm. It's a culture coming together.
Yep. And then part of the weave of the movie is Joan Woodward's narration.
Oh, that
she really is the
Joan
voice.
Joan Woodward
of
is so great. Yeah,
Edith Wharton.
Well, she is. Yes, and there was some. It was actually kind of sweet. Actually, some of the studio guys, they were so supporting the film. It was amazing. Mark Canton and all those guys at Columbia. But they did ask who was speaking, and I never thought of that. Mm-hmm. Somebody's telling me a story. I don't understand.
Yeah.
So why is it a woman? I never thought of that. Well, first of all, it's written by a woman. It seemed kind of odd to have a man's voice to it.
No one could ever be jealous of May's triumphs. She managed to give the feeling that she would have been just as serene without them.
I happen to like narration.
Not just for narrative purposes.
No, no, it's really the feel of it, and it's really tone and atmosphere. And the case of the Edith Wharton, I like the language, I like the use of words. There are some books that you read where you really feel nourished by reading a page or a sentence.
Yeah.
And I wanted to have that along with the visual. Mm. I don't know if we get back into whether a novel could be made into a film. So I don't even want to get into that. But like, it's something different. Yeah. But why couldn't we have a taste of that? Why couldn't we have a taste of what it sounds like when you read aloud? I don't know. It just seems to me that the words are beautiful.
There are also things cinematically that feel like they grow right out of the novel. And I was thinking, for instance, of the way at the opening ball that the camera keeps slowing down, that the speed slows down in the middle of a shot. And I remember the film is shot on Super 35 to give you more leeway with the lenses.
The lenses, and also at that time we were able to change the speed of the camera very easily.
Yeah.
There was a new device that was created, the Arri,
yeah.
And we were able to do that, so we played with it a bit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was trying to find a different visual expression of that world in that time.
This was a world balanced so precariously that its harmony could be shattered by a whisper.
And then a really neat thing from, I want to say it's a documentary for like some cable channel like A&E or something, but I can't remember where it comes from, but it's called Innocence and Experience, and it's a 1993 documentary on the making of the film, which goes into a lot of detail.
This is the first novel that you read by Edith Wharton.
Yeah.
And I think she's a remarkable writer. I mean, the story is so strong.
Well, I was particularly struck by her understanding of the men because, yeah. you know, it, you know, it seemed extraordinary that she was able to have that understanding.
I know. Sometimes it would get...
As if she was seeing through their eyes.
Yeah, yeah. And often you would tell me, my God, she's right again.
Yeah. Scary.
It was scary. It's, oh God, you know. That's one of the reasons why I wanted to use the narration from the book. Sections from the book read over the images.
Yeah.
Because of the insight. And, of course, her prose was so beautiful.
Beautiful.
And then there's an essay by film critic Jeffrey O'Brien. So, a very nice Criterion Blu-ray. I'm always happy to see another Scorsese film get a release. But to lead up to this, I showed you Phantom Thread.
You can sew almost anything into the canvas of a coat. When I was a boy, I started to hide things in the linings of the garments. Things that only I knew were there. Secrets.
Good morning.
Will you have dinner with me?
Yes.
Which also just came out on Blu-ray. And I just thought it was serendipitous that the two had come out so close together. I love Phantom Thread. In fact, I still think I like Phantom Thread more than Age of Innocence, personally. I don't know where you landed on that.
I did like Phantom Thread better. Also, I've already told you that I think Daniel Day-Lewis, like many men, but especially Daniel Day-Lewis, looked better old.
Yeah.
Older, sorry, Daniel.
No, I have to agree with that. He's not older. We were talking about how he's kind of like lanky or something. In his younger, I mean, he's still a handsome man in 1993, right. But in 2018, at ostensibly the end of his career, maybe his last movie, I don't know, he looks better.
And it's ironic because in Age of Innocence, there's a part where they show him older and like what he might look like older. And it's funny because it's nothing like what he really looks like. And he looks much better. So,
yeah. No, I think it's interesting too. We didn't talk about it, but the fact that Paul Thomas Anderson directed Phantom Thread, obviously he's a big fan of Scorsese. I'm sure he's a fan of Age of Innocence. And I mean, if you watch like Boogie Nights, you can see he's very much doing a Scorsese, like, and that's one of his earliest movies. But just in terms of camera moves and cinematography, I feel like he's come into his own and sort of become very much his own filmmaker in his own lyrical way. Because I was surprised, like, I thought watching Age of Innocence and Phantom Thread together would be like, oh, they're really kind of similar, but they're actually very different films. Surprisingly, though, they're both love stories.
It's funny because I saw a lot of parallels between the movies.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's cool.
There's just the obvious. They're both period pieces.
Okay.
Besides the fact that Daniel Day-Lewis is in both of them. They both have to do with rules. And one of them has to do more with, like, the larger sense, like Age of Innocence, the larger sense of rules, like
societal
the mores,
rules.
The mores of society. Whereas Phantom Thread has to do with his own rules.
Yeah.
And how he's like very particular.
No, Alma, what are you doing?
There's tea for you.
Don't put the tray on the table, please. Just take it off. I didn't ask for tea.
No, but...
You can take it out, please.
Yes, I can take it out.
It's a bit late now, isn't it?
I'm taking it out.
Yeah, but it's a bit late now, isn't it?
But I'm taking it out.
The tea is going out. The interruption is staying right here with me.
And in both of the films, he's challenged his rules or the rules of society are challenged, and he has to face that. And
But in Age of Innocence, he does the challenging, and in Phantom Thread, he is challenged.
He is challenged. That is true. That is true. But
no, you're right. That's a parallel, definitely.
And they both have, they have different kinds of endings for sure, but there's...
I really like the ending of Phantom Thread even more the second time.
I do too. And there was one part where I can't tell you exactly, but there was one point where it looked like it was going to go a certain way. And I remember I was telling you, I'm like, if it goes that way, I am done with this movie. I am so done.
It's so crazy that an ending could be both things. It almost, you know, that it could be like either I'm completely out of this movie or, oh my gosh, I'm 100% in and then some. And it's the same, it's a spin on the same scenario. Right.
And again, this is very broad strokes, but the endings are both really good in both movies as well. And they both, in a way, I think the endings in both movies make the movie.
Yeah.
There are times where, more times than I'd like there to exist, where the endings sort of like are sort of meh, you know, like
endings are tough. Almost, I mean, it's a cliched thing to say, but with movies, endings can be and are the most difficult thing. And I think because we've seen a lot of movies, you get to a point where you can still like a movie very much, even with a meh ending, because so many movies do have meh endings. It's just really hard to end them perfectly.
Right, right. And also, I mean, yeah, I mean, if everything's great leading up to it, maybe you forgive it. But some endings like these, I think they're both like the icing on the cake. Like they perfectly sum up, or not sum up, but they're the perfect punctuation mark for the movies. Whereas, I mean, and it even happens with TV. Plenty of times I'll see a show and I've watched season after season after season. And you're like, oh no, it comes at the end. And then you're like, oh, what a letdown. Like yeah. Dexter, for instance. You know, certain shows, it's like the ending, you're like, what? And I feel like these were both, you know, as I said, I just think the endings made them.
Both are very complex. Both are very thought-provoking. One is a bit more melancholy than the other.
But they both have like sort of, I don't want to say dark, but there's sadness in both of them for sure.
Yeah.
And I think in both of them, Daniel Day-Lewis isn't necessarily the most happy camper either. You know, I think in both of them, he's obviously a complex character in both of them.
Well, he's obviously a complex person, really. I mean, I think that's where a lot of that comes from. He seems like a very complex dude.
Well, but he's playing character, so I can't judge that based on, I mean, he can be the flattest person ever and still be able to play a complex person.
I beg to differ on that. I don't think so. I think a complex person can play a more complex character and vice versa. I think people that we were watching, I don't even want to bring this movie into what we were watching the other night, but we were watching a movie called Whatever It Takes, which has nothing to do with either of these movies, not even remotely on the level of either of these movies. It's a 2000s high school rom-com. Yeah. And there's a couple actors in that movie that I find, I mean, granted, they're not even remotely on the level of what these movies are. I mean, these movies are art, you know, like truly film as art. And that is much more film as commerce, film as a product. But I still think you can see a nuanced and interesting and complex performance in movies like that. I mean, we were talking about The Duff the other night. I can't believe I'm bringing all these movies into this review. But anyway, there's a couple actors in Whatever It Takes where I was just like, I don't feel like there's a lot going on there. I don't know this person personally, but I do feel like there's a flatness to the performance that I feel like sort of is grounded in the fact that the person themselves may or may not be ultimately that complex. And maybe I'm being totally condescending, which I think I must be based on your face. But
you know,
I really do believe that granted, these are young actors. He's an older actor in both movies. Obviously, in Phantom Thread, it's like the pinnacle of his career. It's the end. And I think that an actor emotionally and psychologically must be bringing so much more into that in these subtle ways that only actors can do. Because I won't pretend that I know how they do it or the nuance. I mean, acting is one of the most nuanced art forms, I think, because there's so much you can do down to just, you know, eye movement or facial expression or head turn, just little tiny things that actors can do to add accent that you may or may not even notice. So I'm thinking of like Daniel Day-Lewis at the end of his career and all that he's one of the great actors. I think we can probably agree that, you know, he's pretty solid as an actor, right?
Yes.
Anyway. I'm figuring he's bringing a lot to this last role, so it was interesting. It was also interesting to see him in 1993 versus 2018. And also,
a lot of things it's not one thing. For instance, the writing has a huge part of it, right?
Sure.
If it's a good story or not. And direction, right? I've seen really good actors have not so strong direction and not do a good role. And then I've seen them in other roles where they're amazing. And maybe they're just more connected to that role. But I think a lot of it has to do with the direction that they're given.
Well, and sometimes I think the direction is somewhat minimal. And they're just allowed to do their thing, kind of. And there's a trust, I think, that, as I understand it, between the director and the actor, where they're just like, the director is basically saying, you've got this.
But again, that's direction.
It is, even without being specific about do this, don't do this, too big, not too big. I think there's definitely a sense of being directed even if you're not, you know? So anyway, but I was so glad that you liked Phantom Thread as much as you did. I still think it's my favorite movie of last year. I know you liked, Wind River a lot, and you liked, what was the other one?
That's the thing is, like, first of all, different genres, comparing them is always difficult for me. And then
I base it on overall emotional and psychological impact for me, you know, what stuck with me longer, what made me think harder, what really got me inside, kind of.
Well, I think also sometimes I have the Raven effect where you're much more attached to what you just saw. And so,
just so you know, for those that don't know, we're talking about our daughter Raven, of course, and how, you know, we just actually yesterday, 2 days ago, asked her about her top 10 films, and like three or four of them were movies,
maybe
that she,
more,
were movies that she had just seen,
recently seen, right? And we know that over all the time, the movies that she rewatched and rewatched and loved were definitely not all on the list. And
one that I brought up, Iron Giant and Fantastic Mr. Fox tonight, and she's like, "Oh yeah," she's like, "Well, I can't have a top 10. They're all my favorites."
See, that's the thing.
And then I was like, "What about The Greatest Showman, which she just watched tonight?" She was like, "Yeah," she thought it was top 10. So.
Actually, we got more into that as we watched it, as opposed to my first thoughts of that. But anyway, so with that whole Raven effect idea, that I think it's easier to remember Phantom Thread because I saw it more recently. Whereas if I saw it right next to Wind River or right next to other movies that I've seen this year, you know, I have mixed feelings about how that works. Like, I don't like to watch movies right after each other because I feel like I don't get the full, like I'm still on the, not the high, but the...
You're still mulling it over. You're still kind of processing.
Yeah. And when another movie comes right after, I feel like I don't have time to finish the ethos of the film doesn't have time to sink in. And another thing is, like, sometimes I almost feel like it's violating me when I have to watch another movie too close. Like, I feel like I'm not done experiencing it. Like, there's certain movies we've seen where I've been very emotional about. I can't even remember what those movies are at this point, but like, I've cried a lot, or it's given me this really, you know, cathartic feeling. And then to watch another movie so close, I feel is almost wrong. I don't know how to explain that. But anyways, again, if I saw all of these movies closer together, as opposed to not right after each other, but like, you know, the next weekend or a couple days later, I may have be easier to compare them in terms of which I like more. But I really did like Phantom Thread. And it's funny because the whole time I'm like thinking, is it going to take this turn, you know, the title and all that. I don't know. The title was really interesting.
Yeah, very poetic. You know, I don't think I told you the story about Paul Thomas Anderson was saying in this interview, actually Rian Johnson interviewed him, and he was saying something about how it's so interesting to hear what inspires a story, you know? And he said one of the things that inspired Phantom Thread was
I had been ill in bed one night, really sick, and my better half looked at me with a love and affection that I hadn't seen in a long time. I thought, wow, well, that's kind of interesting, you know? I really need her to get me soup right now, and she looks like she's enjoying it, you know? So that's kind of maybe one silly thing, but mixed in with that was wanting to work with Daniel again. Yeah. And I think the other thing that happens as you're laying around on your couch watching TCM is that, you know, Rebecca comes on or something like that, and those movies that we all love, and you think, God, that looks good, you know? So I kind of, I'm a fan of those types of, those gothic romance kind of movies. It's some romance stuff the way that Hitchcock did it as well, which is, you're never really supposed to say his name out loud. But, but I suppose, you know, the romance that is in, particularly in Rear Window, I remember that great moment when Jimmy Stewart's watching Grace Kelly take the plunge and go across the street, and he just has this look in his eyes like, that's my girl, you know, he's so in love with her. And I guess it's that kind of combination of that fever and romance that can happen when you look at somebody, and it's kind of gothic and crazy, and it appeals to me.
And I just thought that was really interesting, like, as I said, to see the kind of things that go into an artist's head that then it comes out as this. I mean, again, it's not like he just, that happened. He's like, I'm going to go and write this period piece about a guy who makes dresses. And it, you know, that doesn't, it's not exactly that, but just the things that sort of push you on a path creatively, you know, I think is really fascinating, especially when it's so personal. It's so, this is about me and my wife, and this is where this kind of started. I just think that's kind of beautiful. And I think that the end result is, I mean, how neat is that, you know?
Well, in some ways, and obviously certain movies might not do this, like horror movies and certain things like that. Maybe it doesn't happen as much, but I would think a lot of things come from personal experience. The idea that...
I mean, isn't the best art personal, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So there has to be something that inspires it and some truth to it in order, You know, obviously there's some things that are fantasy, but maybe those even come out in someone's dreams or somebody's, you know, wishes of, you know, fantasies of themselves, like what they would hope for. You know, it's funny. There's this, even I'm saying horror, not as much because there's like some creepy things in there, but maybe that happens in people's psyche too. And it's funny. There's this famous photographer, Joel Peter Witkin, and I show him every year to my students, and
he's pretty awesome.
And one thing that's interesting to me is there's a story, and same thing like with Frida Kahlo, there are certain stories that you wonder, are they true or are they partially fictionalized in order to give that person some mystique? And one of the stories is the reason why his images are so dark and morbid and macabre is that supposedly when he was a young boy, he was going to, I think, church, but he was going with his mom. And on the way, there was a car accident and somebody got decapitated and he saw the head roll up towards the curb.
And it sounds supposedly a little bit dramatic.
I don't know. But anyways, that's
I mean, but if you go and look at his work, you could extrapolate like, wow, this kid must have seen somebody's head roll up on there because it's so...
I don't know if I'd extrapolate that. But it makes sense that it would
with his work,
darkness.
I believe it more than others, let's say. But anyway, yeah, those kind of stories are interesting. I didn't realize. You never told me that. Yeah, I think it's always intriguing, again, to see where artists draw inspiration because so much of people processing art, I think, is trying to go, where does this come from? And the... almost always the thing they want to go to is like, oh, that's autobiographical. So you'd look at Phantom Thread and go, oh, P.T. Anderson, you know, had some girl that, you know, like trying to sort of extrapolate a personal story out of it is the most simplistic A to B that I think we can do. Like, because a lot of times, you know, they say write what you know and whatnot. And so there is a sense of putting personal detail into those stories and your art. But I do think it's, again, the word complex comes up. It's so much more complex than that. There's so many things that get inside, you know, your head and then it comes out in this whole different way. And I guess I've always been and will always be fascinated with the artistic process and how different things, like the same thing could happen to two different people and the art that is created because of it is completely different.
Well, it's funny because I think back to being in school and exercises like in English classes about writing the same story from different perspectives, or even in photography, like the idea of taking pictures from different perspectives. And so it's funny that you talk about like the idea of writing what you know. And I've heard that phrase before. But to me, like it makes me think about actors who go and they study these other people so that they can play roles similar to that or from that perspective, like mental illness or someone who is incarcerated or someone who has something different outside of themselves.
Is it like sociopathic killer or, you know,
yeah,
something
or whatever,
that is
right.
not
and I don't,
at all that person, you know?
Yeah, and I don't think that people who write that, I think that they could easily do research to find that stuff too, that it doesn't always have to come, like, be autobiographical. It could be something that intrigues them or something that, you know what I'm saying? Anyways, we're getting a little off topic.
No, anyway. I think it's all... It's just the kind of things that go through your head after you see a really good movie or you experience some great piece of art. I think that's the thing that will keep me going back for the rest of my life is the really good ones, you know? I mean, it's fun to watch the junky ones too. I mean, it always obviously gives you perspective, but it's just the great stuff like this that I think always will inspire me, but I love sharing it and I'm so glad we did this just because it was kind of neat to watch two movies of his so close together. And I don't know, it's not like a film class or anything, but it's just like a mini, you know, sampler that.
But I do think there's a lot more parallels between the movies if you check them out and see it. There's a lot more, but some of them may be spoilers. So
yeah, well, I would agree that you're right. People should, you know, now that both are on Blu-ray, definitely pick up both Blu-rays and watch them close together and see what it stirs in you or see the complexity of the endings and how that affects you. You know, I don't know. Maybe you're not a romantic person. Maybe it's the kind of thing that you'll just be like, well, this is just hogwash, because a lot of people still use that word, right? Anyway, that will do it for this episode. I think I'm going to do something different in that I'm going to, instead of saying goodbye, I'm going to lead right into an episode I recorded by myself about another Criterion title, The Awful Truth. So I think I'm just going to segue right into that and have a double episode. I know, real fancy, right? So anyway, thank you, wife, for joining me.
Goodbye, husband.
I really appreciate it. On to the awful truth.
Oh, undoubtedly, he has a better sense of humor than I have, too.
Oh, no, no, I beg to differ with you there. Right now, you're twice as funny as he ever thought of being.
Quit stalling, Lucy.
Well, I'm not trying.
Perhaps our marriage doesn't mean anything to you.
Oh, but it does.
Perhaps you have no sentiment left for me. Look at this. Look, a letter I wrote you. But did you care when you read it? No. No. You knew there'd be a letter from me every morning. But you were far too busy with Armand Louvel to give it a thought.
It's enough to destroy one's faith, isn't it?
Oh, I haven't any faith left in anyone.
I know just how you feel.
What do you mean?
You didn't happen to mention it in any of your letters what a terrible rainy spell they were having in Florida. The papers were full of it.
Well, I can explain that, Lucy.
You can?
Yeah, and don't try to change the subject. You think a great offense is a great defense. Don't try to justify your behavior by insinuating things about me.
But I haven't any behavior to justify. I've just been unlucky, that's all. You've come home and caught me in a truth, and it seems there's nothing less logical than the truth.
A philosopher, huh?
You don't believe me.
Oh, how can I believe you? The car broke down. People stopped believing that one before a car stopped breaking down.
Well, his car's very old.
Yeah, well, so's his story.
So the disc says, in this Oscar-winning farce, Cary Grant, in the role that first defined the Cary Grant persona, and Irene Dunne exude charm, cunning, and artless affection as an urbane couple who, fed up with each other's infidelities, resolve to file for divorce. But try as they might to move on, the mischievous Jerry can't help meddling in Lucy's ill-matched engagement to a corn-fed Oklahoma businessman, Ralph Bellamy, and a mortified Lucy begins to realize that she may be saying goodbye to the only dance partner capable of following her lead. Directed by the versatile Leo McCary, a master of improvisation and slapstick, as well as a keen and sympathetic observer of human folly, The Awful Truth is a warm but unsparing comedy about two people whose flaws only make them more irresistible. That's very well put. Yeah, I love this movie. I think as much as it is an Academy Award winner, I still don't think it's as well known or as oft talked about as things like His Girl Friday and Bringing Up Baby. And the back is certainly correct in that it seems to be where Cary Grant kind of got started. You know, the Cary Grant that we know and love wasn't necessarily fully defined until this movie, I don't think. And there's a lot of evidence in the supplements, which I'll get to in just a second, to offer a good case for that. But just so people are aware, Leo McCary is really fantastic comedy director, one of the great directors of the period. And not only did he basically unite Laurel and Hardy and work with them a ton, he also worked with a ton of other comedy giants like Harold Lloyd in The Milky Way in 1936.
The big boys used to pick on me. They threw things at me. Bricks and tomatoes. You know, like kids do. So I learned to duck.
What?
To duck. See what I mean? Oh, I had to. I finally got so good at it that I could put my hands in my pockets and bet the kids pennies they couldn't knock my hat off. They couldn't either. You know, once I made enough to take my mother and my sister May to the picture show. Say, you met her last night.
Look here. I'm trying to find out how the chap got knocked out, and you keep talking about milk and puny babies and movies.
Now, this isn't going to get you anywhere. How'd you like to have me do that to you?
Yeah, that's right. All right, go ahead.
Now I don't know where I was.
Now listen, Sully. You were a puny little boy, and you took your mother and sister to a picture show. Now do you remember?
Oh, yes. I even remember the picture. Do you remember the one where the man locked the girl in his cabin? And he chased her round and round.
Oh, that one? Yes.
You do?
Yes.
How did it end? My mother took me home.
Take the witness.
W.C. Fields in a little movie called Six of a Kind in 1934. That one's pretty cool. It's also got George Burns and Gracie Allen and Charlie Ruggles.
Hi.
Like to buy a sweater.
A sweater?
Moses! Where'd that Eskimo go to?
Sweater. Just to give me an idea of size, try this on, will ya? How's that feel?
It's a little too tight.
Tight? Say. That's funny. It fits me perfectly.
I'd like to buy a sweater.
Hmm. I could give you that in black. Here we have it. Here we are. Here. Try on this this is a rather tricky little feature, though. I'll get you something with buttons.
Look.
Here's something in a larger size.
Listen, I came in
Sit
here...
Sit down. Try this on. How does that feel?
It's a little too loose.
You're rather difficult, brother. Fit me perfectly.
I came in here to buy...
Oh, just a moment, just a moment. Right before my very eyes all the time. Try this on. Funny, they fit me perfectly.
Say, what about the sweater?
I don't think I'll need it.
Pretty fun. I only saw that for the first time this year. He also worked with Eddie Cantor in The Kid from Spain in 1932.
This is the young man who was found in the girls' dormitory.
So, this is the guilty student?
Yes, Dean.
I deeply regret the occurrence in your dormitory this morning, and I trust that you'll express my feelings to all of your girls. Finding a boy in one of the girls' beds is not the best advertisement for a coeducational institution, is it?
Hardly.
No, I should say not. I've been dean of this institution for over 30 years, and I hardly know where the girls' dormitory is.
You go right through this door and you turn to the right.
Silence!
Have you told Miss Oliver who is responsible for your predicament?
He admits all the guilt himself.
Indeed. Well, now that's very commendable, young man. But perhaps you'll tell me...
Well, Dean, you see, there's really nothing to tell. I just grew tired of sleeping with the fellows and thought I'd try the girls' dormitory.
Oh!
For a change. You know how it is. Or you wouldn't know. You didn't even know where the girls...
And, of course, the Marx Brothers in what is often hailed as their greatest film, and that is Duck Soup from 1933.
Oh! How'd you get in here?
Oh, Your Excellency, I'm so sorry to have to disturb you. Will you ever forgive me?
After I leave here tonight, will you ever forgive me? Here are the plans of war. They're as valuable as your life, and that's putting them pretty cheap. Watch them like a cat watches her kittens. Have you ever had kittens? No, of course not. You're too busy running around playing bridge. Can't you see what I'm trying to tell you? I love you. Why don't you marry me?
Why, marry you?
You take me and I'll take a vacation. I'll need a vacation if we're going to get married. Married. I can see you right now in the kitchen, bending over our hot stove. But I can't see the stove. Come, say the word and you'll never see me again.
So he's already like a comedy veteran, you know, a total pro before he gets to this movie. And I think that's a unique position to be in, to have all that experience and have sort of an improvisational style where he would sort of develop bits on his own and with the, you know, comic actors that he's using on the set. You know, the script would be very much a formality, you know, for the studio. And yeah, so he's great. And this is one of his best films, and one that everybody should see. And if you haven't seen any Cary Grant films, it's a great place to start. If you've seen His Girl Friday and you haven't seen The Awful Truth, definitely worth your time, worth a blind buy. Anyway, I just love this movie, and I love the chemistry between Irene Dunne and Cary Grant. Even in the midst of a divorce comedy, their chemistry is totally sparkling. You know, they both have amazing timing, and this film really just is an incredible showcase for both actors. Yeah, it's... It's just got so many funny scenes, from the opening bit where they decide to get the divorce.
Well, let me tell you something.
Now, let me tell you something. I've told you the truth about all this, Jerry. Don't you see that there can't be any doubt in marriage? The whole thing's built on faith. If you've lost that, well, you've lost everything.
Yes, I suppose when that's gone, the marriage is washed up, isn't it?
Do you mean that?
Uh-huh.
All right, then, that settles it.
Oh, I guess it does.
I wouldn't go on living with you if you were dipped in platinum. So go on, divorce me. Go on, divorce me. It'll be a pleasure.
Divorce you? Are you crazy? Do you think I'd drag that music lover into court to show people the man you preferred to me?
All right, then I'll divorce you. I believe it's customary anyhow for the wife to bring suit. It has something to do with the husband being a gentleman, if you know what I mean.
Oh, never mind that stuff. Just get on with the divorce proceedings. I can hardly wait.
I'll call up our lawyer right now.
All right, here.
If you don't mind my using him, I don't know anyone else. You get around so much more than I do.
That's so.
Hello? Hello, Lucy. What's that? Divorce? You and Jerry? Now, Lucy. Don't do anything in haste that you might regret later. Marriage is a beautiful thing and you should give it every...
Why can't we call you back after we finished eating?
Please be quiet, will you? Seem agitated, Lucy. Try and calm yourself. I hate to see you take any hasty action in a matter like this. Marriage is a beautiful
thing
and...
Why don't you finish your meal? Why can't we call you back later?
Please shut your mouth. As I was saying, Lucy, marriage is a beautiful thing. And when you've been married as long as I have, you'll appreciate it, too.
Your food is getting ice cold. You're always complaining about your food.
Big mouth. I'll eat when I get good and ready, and if you don't like it, you know what you can do. So shut up. Lucy, darling, marriage is a beautiful thing.
And an incredible scene where Ralph Bellamy and Irene Dunne sing Home on the Range.
I'm so sorry.
That's all right. Home
on the range, where the deer and the antelope play. Where shall love is heard, a discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy.
Not bad.
Which, by the way, I have a clip here of Ralph Bellamy talking about getting the part and how little he knew about the character. And it's actually kind of fascinating to hear him talk about the process and how that was the first thing they shot, I guess.
And word came from the studio manager on a Friday, come to the studio Monday morning to do The Awful Truth. And I said, where's the script? And he said, I don't know. Leo McCary's going to direct it, and he's got it. So I said, what clothes shall I bring? What kind of a character is it? And he said, I don't know. He said, just bring a lot of clothes. So Monday morning, I came in an odd jacket and trousers and arms full of clothes. And Leo McCary, who was a dazzling little fellow with sparkling eyes, always grinning, came forward and said, good morning. And I said, they didn't tell me anything about this part. I don't know what I'm playing. And they didn't tell me what to wear. I brought a lot of clothes. He said, what have you got on? I said, an odd jacket and trousers that I came to the studio. And he said, it's just what I want. So I put the clothes down. He said, can you sing? I said, I can't get from one note to another. He said, oh, that's just what I want. And I said, this is a Western fellow from Oklahoma, and he's in New York with his mother. Got a Western accent. And he said, Irene's over there at the piano, and the camera is set up. He said, do you know the words to Home on the Range? And I said, yeah, but I can't sing it. I can't sing. And he said, that's what I want. That's just what I want. He said, come on over here. So I went over, and Irene was trying to play Home on the Range. She was saying, Leo, I can never get this because I don't read well, and I don't know what's going to come out. He said, it's fine. It's just what I want. He said, you play it, and Ralph, you sing it. And you're a Western fellow, charming fellow, kind of a little goofy, and just belt it out. So she played, and she was picking it out from the sheet music, and I was bellowing it out, and finished, and it was dead silence. Nobody said cut. And finally, I looked up. McCary was literally under the camera on the floor, dying laughing. Say, he said, cut it, print it. And that was the first thing we did. That was in the picture. At the end of the day, nobody knew exactly where we were going. There was no script. We all tried to get out of it. Cary Grant offered to do another picture that less money, or two pictures for one, or the cost of one, or something. And Irene said, I can't do this, let me out of it. And I said to Harry, I don't know what I'm doing here, and I don't know where we're going with it. I don't know what the story is. Harry said, leave it to McCary. I have turned it over to him. Well, he would come in each morning, often with a piece of brown wrapping paper. And he'd say, now, and he would die laughing telling us this. He'd say, you come in over there, and you come in that door, and I'll run the dog through here or something. I'm just making this up. And there's a ring at the front door, whatever. Well, this is the way, for the next two or three days, we did this thing. But we realized after the two or three days that he knew what he was going to do. There never was a script. They recorded what we shot, which became the script, and it turned out to be a very successful picture.
Yeah, so Ralph Bellamy's great. I just love that he's a good sport, and he's up to be kind of the schmo in both this movie and His Girl Friday. But there's tons of great scenes in this, and it's got a really clever ending, which I always found really amusing, because they're in the midst of, like, the Hays Code and, you know, a couple that's about to be divorced. I don't want to spoil it. Anyway, it's just clever. But there's another great scene that I love, not to be all whatever about just telling different scenes, but it's such a classic. Just that after they've sort of split and she's courting Ralph Bellamy, Cary Grant comes by her place to visit the dog, and it just goes to a very funny place.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Mr. Leeson. This is my husband.
Oh.
He's only my husband for, how much longer is it now, 60 days?
59.
Ah, that's better. Only 59 days. And don't worry about him. He has a continental mind.
Yes.
Excuse
me, what do you say?
I say I'm glad to know you.
How can you be glad to know me? I know how I'd feel if I was sitting with a girl and her husband walked in.
I'll bet you do.
You know, I don't think you ought to go around telling people you're not married. He looks like a nice sort of fella. How do you think he feels?
Why don't you go and play with the dog?
Why don't you go on with whatever you were doing? I'm gonna... Don't mind me. Any new dogs in the neighborhood? Been chasing any cats?
Come on, sit down, Mr. Leeson. Tell me some more about Arizona.
Oklahoma.
I mean Oklahoma. That's me for you.
Hey, is he getting enough to eat lately? He doesn't look very well.
What, you don't look so hot yourself.
I don't think he's getting enough exercise. He's got circles under his eyes.
Okay.
The court ruled.
Hey, what about a tune, boy?
Every so often. Yes, you see, there's sure. Nothing we can
come
do
on.
About it.
Let's go. No.
But don't mind that, Mr. Leeson. Go right ahead.
Attaboy, get out, man.
So this is a really nice Criterion package. It's got some solid supplements, including a new interview with film critic Gary Giddens about director Leo McCary. I really like this a lot. It's about 24 minutes. And Giddens talks about how much Cary Grant was initially horrified by the way McCary worked, the sort of improvising on set, and how McCary actually helped develop the comic Cary Grant persona that we know and love, and that it was kind of, you know, the calling card movie that, in a way, set him up to be hired for His Girl Friday and, you know, working with Howard Hawks and doing a lot of his now classic roles. This was kind of the movie that made people aware, oh my gosh, he's incredible. Yeah, it was just so funny to hear how much Cary Grant wasn't ready to be in this movie, you know? Just was ready to totally quit and wanted to switch parts with Ralph Bellamy. Like, basically was so, I guess, underconfident in what was happening and the process of it that he was ready to bail on it completely. And to think what would have happened if he hadn't persevered or if Leo McCary hadn't stayed on him to continue to make this movie, it just would have changed everything. We might not have the Cary Grant that we know. But anyway, that's a really great little feature. There's something called Tell Me Lies About Cary Grant, which is 16 minutes. That's a new video essay from film critic David Cairns. And it's sort of a fascinating look at the evolution of Grant's on-screen persona. And you can see via clips from all the films he did prior to Awful Truth, like how he changes and gets closer, but not quite there until he's actually working with Leo McCary. And it just seems that Cary becomes Cary really clearly in this movie. So it's just neat to see all the little clips from some of his lesser-known films pre-Awful Truth. I haven't seen several of these. Some of them seem to be odd vehicles for him, especially as the guy that we would come to love as Cary Grant. It just feels like different studios and filmmakers trying to find a place for him and trying on different outfits in this sort of character way that that don't quite work. But anyway, it's a really neat little video essay. And then there is an interview with Irene Dunne herself from 1978. It's only about 7 minutes, but it's a really neat, insightful interview with her. And she talks about her working relationship with McCary, which is pretty cool to hear in her own words. Yeah, she's something else. I really like Irene Dunne a lot. So that is The Awful Truth. And I thought to go along with it, why not offer a pairing? And this may be kind of obvious, and it's probably been done at rep houses for years, but it's another movie that I don't feel like enough people have seen, and that's Mr. and Mrs. Smith, directed by Mr. Alfred Hitchcock in 1941.
You'll see Carol Lombard and Robert Montgomery together for the first time. You'll see one of the funniest comedy situations that ever hit the screen. You'll see what happens when Mr. and Mrs. Smith discover that they were never legally married.
Yeah, so I think this one would pair really well with it. And it's... let me just read the back of the DVD. Sadly, there's no Blu-ray of this yet that I know of. It says, "If you had it all to do over again, would you have married me? Yes, guys, there is a right answer. That's something David Smith learns the hard way when bubbly, better half Anne queries him over breakfast."
"You know it was all my fault."
"No, Andy, it was mine."
"My fault, dear."
"Mm-mm. My darling, I shouldn't be jealous so much, and I should lay off your family."
"A wife should conduct herself to please her husband. That's one of the rules I'm going to make."
"Another one?"
"Mm-hmm. What's the day today?"
Darling, I think I better be running along."
"Oh, no, honey, not just yet. Remember rule number 7?
"Yes, but I thought we'd given that one up. It always got us into so much trouble."
"Well, if we ever give up one, that means we're giving up just that much of our wonderful relationship. That we're letting down. You wouldn't want me to feel that, would you?"
"But those questions you ask each month. Like about that trip I took to Paris the year I graduated from college. I was only 21.
"Well, I forgave you that."
"Shoot."
"If you had it all to do over again, would you have married me?"
"Honestly, no. Not that I'd want to be married to anyone else, but I think that when a man marries, he gives up a certain amount of freedom and independence. If I had to do it all over again, I think I would stay single. You wanted me to answer you truthfully because we respect each other. We're honest with each other. Your feelings aren't hurt, are they?"
"Oh, no, it's perfectly all right."
"It's enough of that. I was getting into trouble."
"I'm not angry in the least."
"Oh, yes, you are. You don't understand. I was only answering a hypothetical question of what I would do if I had to do it all over again."
"David, if you want your freedom, I don't want to be the kind of a wife who clings to her husband when she's not wanted."
"Darling, I do want to be married to you. I love you. I worship you. I am used to you. How do we always get into these things?"
"Well, if my only hold on you is that you're used to me."
"Oh, now, you've got the whole thing wrong. I don't know what I'd do without you. You are my little girl. Now, don't cry. Don't cry. Forgive me? Say you forgive me. Now, can I go to work?"
Also write are radiant Carol Lombard and easygoing Robert Montgomery as the stars of this breezy Alfred Hitchcock comedy. For 3 years, the Smiths have been blissed but battling. But when a technicality voids their union, Mr. Mrs. Mrs. orbiting the tail into the delightful cockamamie of the screwball genre. From a script by Academy Award winner Norman Krasna, Hitchcock made his change of pace foray into all-out humor memorable. "Here again are his unmistakable touches," Look declared. "The net effect is the same, too, another Alfred Hitchcock hit." So Hitch didn't do a lot of comedies. I mean, he always infused a lot of his work with comedy, but this is the most straight screwball that he ever did.
"Now."
"Now what?"
"Are you going to stop this silly farce or aren't you? I've got a lot of work piled up for me at the office. I've just been through a 3-day session of this nonsense, and I haven't any more time for these games of yours. You can come home now, and I'm willing not to discuss it anymore."
"That's very generous of you. Who do you think you're talking to?"
"My wife."
"We're not married."
"Are you out of your mind? Certainly we're married. What do you mean, after 3 years, we're not married?"
"Legally, we're not married."
"Oh, for... all right, we'll get married. Does that satisfy you?"
"We'll get married. That's a nice, snarling proposal. Listen here, you had a hard enough job to get me to marry you before, and I didn't know you. But I do now, and how I know you. And if anyone asks you, you're no bargain."
"Well, what's the matter with me?"
I don't want this discussion to run into hours. I'm very busy.
Name one thing about me you don't like.
One thing. Why aren't we vain?
One thing I am not is vain.
What about that tar stuff you keep rubbing in your hair that smells up my whole bedroom?
I am only trying to save my hair for you. And you're a fine one to talk. Going to bed with those aluminum clips in your hair. You turned over one night and cut me in 20 places.
You needn't worry. You won't be cut anymore.
I'm not going to stand any more of this, and that's my final word on the matter.
Nice to have met you.
I'm not going to support you. What do you think of that?
Fine.
No, I mean it. You're not going to get any more money.
Who asked you?
And it's a unique outlier for that trait alone. But yeah, between Carol Lombard, who's one of the great actresses of all time, I mean, certainly in a class with Irene Dunne, but I maybe prefer Carol Lombard. I don't know. They're both fantastic ladies and incredible comedic actresses, really remarkable talents. But yeah, I like Robert Montgomery. He can be kind of charming and kind of dickish in this very specific way that can be amusing. But yeah, this one, it's not as fun as The Awful Truth. In The Awful Truth, it's really neat to see Cary Grant and Irene Dunne kind of giving each other a hard time. You know, when they're split up, it's clear they just want to torture each other, but in that way that you might think two people that really care about each other and seem fit to be together would do. You know, like, that's a real specific kind of chemistry. And this has a similar thing, but it's not quite that chemistry.
You know, I think if we told each other just one lie, we'd have to admit we failed, wouldn't we?
Mm-hmm.
And what would we have left? Marriage like other people's. Doubt, distrust, going on with each other because it's the easiest way.
Mr. and Mrs. Smith is probably the most untypical Hitchcock picture. It has no murder. It's basically a screwball comedy. He always said that he did it as a tribute to Carol Lombard, whom he loved and who wanted to make a picture with him. And screwball comedy, the phrase, was named after a performance of Carol Lombard's in Nothing Sacred, when people said, this is a real screwball dame, and the phrase caught on and it became a genre, screwball comedy. So she's the queen of screwball comedy, Carol Lombard. The picture is very efficiently done. It shows that Hitchcock could do any genre he wanted to do. It's as well made as anybody could make a screwball comedy. The two actors, both Robert Montgomery and Carol Lombard, are very proficient and likable and personable actors who are very good at that sort of thing, and they do it very well, and Hitchcock's camera is always in the right place.
Regardless, I think it's a really interesting and funny Hitchcock comedy. And like I said, no Blu-ray yet, so clearly not enough of a big deal to get that kind of release, which says to me that maybe not enough people are clamoring for it, which is too bad, because it's a neat little Hitch film. So hopefully a Blu-ray is coming in the future. But regardless, I think it would play well as a follow-up to The Awful Truth, and I think that is well worth your time. Anyway, that is it for this classic comedy-centric episode. I hope you've enjoyed it. I hope you pick up The Awful Truth. It's just a must-own. And I hope you have a lovely and Blu-ray-filled week. And I will talk to you soon. Bye-bye.